You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring the Social Brand Forum. This industry-leading digital marketing event brings the best and brightest thought leaders to the heart of the heartland for 2 days of insightful keynotes and interactive discussions. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Mark W. Schaefer. Mark is a globally recognized author, speaker, educator, and business consultant who blogs at Grow, one of the top marketing blogs of the world. He teaches graduate marketing classes at Rutgers University and has written 4 best-selling books, including The Tao of Twitter, the best-selling book on Twitter in the world, and The Return on Influence, which was named one of the top business titles of the year by the American Library Association. His clients include Dell, Adidas, and the U.S. Air Force. He has been a keynote speaker at prestigious events all over the world, including South by Southwest, Marketing Summit Tokyo, and the Institute for International and European Affairs. Mark is also the author of the new book, The Content Code, and a keynote speaker at this fall's Social Brand Forum here in Iowa. Mark, welcome to On Brand.
I am delighted to be here, and I can't wait to get back to Iowa. I used to go there all the time on business, and I haven't been there in probably maybe 7 or 8 years.
Well, you know, this is a new experience for me. Many of the Social Brand Forum speakers, I'm checking Iowa off their box of their list of states I visited. It's an elusive one for many, but you've
I have crawled all over that state.
Crawled even.
I have.
Well, that's great. Well, we're glad to have you back in the tall corn state, the Hawkeye state. So I went with the short version of the Mark Schaefer bio.
Thank goodness.
but what did we miss in there? You're a busy globe-trotting guy. Is there anything that didn't make the short bio cut that's important for folks to know about you, who you are, and what you do?
Well, I think I'm a teacher in everything that I do. So if you look at the common theme, of course, I'm an educator at Rutgers. But whether you look at my books or my blog or my speeches, I teach. I love to help people. I'm just at a great place in my life where, you know, I've been out there working in the trenches for more than 30 years. I've had great educational experiences, and I've had a chance to learn from some of the best in the business. And so I think it boils down to I'm a teacher, and that's what really rewards me.
You know, that's interesting because there's a lot of people in our circles that have kind of the triple threat of, you know, consultant, speaker, author. But you don't often see educator bolted on there. And I like what you said about being an educator. I mean, in the traditional sense of you have classes that you teach, as I do. But I also like that you kind of laddered that up in that everything. And I think that that's what makes your books so approachable and your talks so innovative, is that it is really an exercise in teaching.
Yeah. And I think it's been an interesting blend, and it's been a great learning experience for me, because teaching really isn't about just spewing information. There's a real process to it. And I find that that transfers also very well, not just in the classroom, but also to speaking, because if you stand up there and just spew information, I mean, people are just going to be overwhelmed. They'll believe me, I've made that mistake. You know, I started out thinking, oh, well, I'm a teacher now, or I'm a speaker. I have to give them incredible value by just telling them everything that I know. And that's not really how it works. You kind of have to back off and say, how do people really process this? How am I going to create something that people are really going to remember? And that gets a lot into storytelling. I don't think there's ever a person that walks away from one of my speeches that would be able to say, oh, here are the five bullets he had on his slide. But they will be able to say, you know, he told this great story. And that's what they remember. And that's how they can articulate the main points of what I'm trying to get across.
Well, and that makes me think, too, of, you know, taking this from, you know, what you do to what brands do and what they're struggling with. And I think, you know, storytelling is an elusive concept for many. I mean, especially when we think about it in a business context. You know, we have all of the baggage of the, you know, it's a bedtime story or the traditional, you know, kind of aspects of storytelling. You know, I sell, you know, plumbing supplies. Why do I care about storytelling? But I think from your latest book, to everything that you talk about, I mean, I think storytelling, wouldn't you say, matters more than ever?
Well, storytelling, I'm conflicted on that, to be honest with you. You know, because honestly, you know, I come from the corporate world. I mean, I know, excuse me, I know what it's like to live and work in this environment, especially when you're a public company. And you've got these pressures. You've got to hit these quarterly numbers inexorably. Without fail, you have to create more value, create more profits. And there's a lot of pressure on these short-term actionable things. And it's difficult culturally for companies to move into this the storytelling mode where you're taking a long time to build these relationships. I think it's important. I think it must be done, but I'm certainly sympathetic. I can understand why it's hard for companies to embrace this. And so I'm more patient with this stuff. I'm not as cut and dry and a purist as maybe some other people out there, that I think you have to look at things very practically, very rationally. You have to look at things in the context of culture. And some company cultures are further along than others in terms of their ability to embrace this. I think one of the biggest disservices that ever happened in the world of marketing is when we elevated Zappos to the ultimate storytelling social enterprise company. And now everybody says, oh, I want to be like Zappos. Well, to be like Zappos, first of all, you've got to be Zappos. You've got to have this extraordinarily weird culture and this extraordinarily innovative CEO in Tony Hsieh. And not every company has that. In fact, no company has that. So you have to be able to fit your social media, your content, branding, your storytelling into the context of the culture.
You know, that's interesting because you talk about elevating Zappos, and it's certainly one of the more ubiquitous examples out there. But I also wonder, you know, we're both educators, and you know, the backbone of teaching is our case studies. I sometimes think, and I mention this every now and then, that we are over case studied on things. That it kind of encourages, you know, some of this laziness that I'll just see what Zappos or what's worse is when you're waiting for what someone in your industry is doing, and you just say, okay, great, I'm just going to grab that and we'll do that.
Well, I think there's a, you know, the case study method, excuse me again, is a two-edged sword. And when I got my MBA, it was from Claremont Graduate University, and I had the great fortune to study for 3 years under Peter Drucker. And he taught by basically the Harvard case study method. And the thing that he drove into our minds over and over again, because you had this room filled with these high-performing executives, they wanted to solve it. They wanted to come up with the answer. And he would just blitz those people, and he'd say, look, your job isn't necessarily to come up with the answer. It's to come up with the questions. That's what leadership is all about. You're not necessarily expected to have all the right answers all the time, but you should have the right questions to find the right answer for your organization. I think that's the value of case studies, to explore the whys. You know, you got to ask why five times, they say, in the Toyota production system. And I think, you know, that applies to marketing and marketing strategy as well, that we can't look at a case study and say it's going to fit for our organization. You need to dig down and figure out, why did this work? Why did it work in that time period? Why did it work with those people and their corporate structure? And then take the lessons from that, not as a blanket story, but as lessons that we can apply to our own individual organizational context.
You know, you talked about the classroom feeding the work that you do elsewhere, and I would second that notion. And I also think it's fascinating because you're talking to marketers at both sides of their careers or at many different stages. Do you find, is there a skill set, whether it's the critical thinking that was just mentioned, or something that you think is the most lacking in marketing curriculum today?
Oh, that's easy. you just hit on a huge hot button.
Good. I will sit back now.
I mean, I think marketing education in our country is really pathetic in general. It's really falling behind in a critical way. And I am fortunate where I get to go to a lot of universities. I do guest lectures. I Skype in virtually. I've gotten to know a lot of these teachers and what they're struggling with for many years now. And I see the two big institutional problems are a lot of the teachers who cut their teeth in our business 10 or 15 years ago and now are at faculty and universities, they haven't kept up, and that's a problem. And then the curriculums aren't really adaptable to the fast-changing pace of marketing. In a marketing curriculum at a big university school to get a university school, yeah, right, at a big university, to fit into the accreditation process, it might take 2 years to get a new class approved. And so there's really a big problem out there. And the biggest single shortfall is in analytics. If I were to hire a new marketing employee today, it would probably be someone with a strong statistical background. And marketing increasingly is math. We have all this data coming at us. And many times it's big data. Well, how do we tease the wisdom out of that? How do we tease competitive advantage from what we can find in these numbers through our analysis, through clever algorithms to tease out the truth? That's where the real value is today. And I'm seeing a lot of the students coming out of these programs, and if you talk about this subject, they just have a complete blank look on their face.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head too. With it's not a pretty curve in looking at how fast marketing is changing, and how slow the process is. Like you said, even to get a new course, much less a pretty advanced overhaul of a curriculum.
Here I live in Tennessee, at the University of Tennessee. You know, a major national level university, they have not one class in digital marketing, not one. And that's not unusual at many large universities. And how in the world can you be educating students today and overlook, you know, the biggest driver in our business right now?
Well, I think, you know, you talked about, you know, some that may not have kept up. I think the big thing that, I mean, because I, the course that I teach was, I believe, the first. And for about half the time I taught it, it was kind of hidden under, you know, kind of where, in terms of like the course number and the name, like some sort of contemporary topics in marketing, you know. So we didn't want to like commit a real number or a name to it. But it has finally become listed. But I think there's so many that want to just kind of hold their breath and wait for this to pass that that all things digital are just going to kind of, you know, it's a passing fad, I think.
I think for many listeners, that's going to seem like a shocking statement, but I agree with you. I mean, I was actually brought in to a large university to do a half-day workshop with their business professors and their journalism professors on social media marketing. And some of the professors were literally belligerent, saying, you know, we need to stick to the basics. This is just, you know, stuff for kids. This is stuff that's going to pass. And, you know, at one point, I mean, I took it up to a certain point, and I finally turned to one of the belligerent professors, and I said, "Madam, you could not be more wrong." And I said, I wasn't going to get, you know, bore you with statistics, but let me get into a few statistics here. And so I got, you know, I dove deep into some other, you know, presentations I wasn't planning to give that day, thinking that I would have a ready audience, and I didn't. And so, you know, by the lunch break, she was, you know, she seemed to be on board and a little bit more open. But yeah, it's incredible to me. I had a professor at a big Midwest university come up to me after my talk, and she said, I really haven't gotten into social media. Do you think I should? And I'm thinking, well, do you want to be relevant? I mean, I think it's just that simple.
Yeah, yeah. It's challenging, and you know, you move at different paces too. I mean, I think as I've spent more time there, I've learned how to also not blow my stack every time there's some of the differences in speed. But I think to be of service to the students, I think we have to push in that direction. I mean, that's the biggest job, despite, you know, other personalities in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in thinking about all of this, what role do you think in terms of a marketing education? Because one thing I'm also concerned about is that we have these educations these silos built up in education between, you know, where business is happening and where we're focusing on content creation as well. And, you know, you've got College of Business over here, you've got communications in most schools over here, and not a lot of cross-pollination. What do you think of this, the role of understanding content creation in a marketing education?
Well, that's, you know, that's really a great question, and I think the idea of cross-pollination is a very rich subject too. Because if you look at my world, where a lot of the value being created today, the economic value, is through startups. I mean, America is startup frenzy. I met this very well-known venture capitalist at South by Southwest, and he mentioned to me that 75% of all the VC money in the world is in America, and 50% of that is in California. And so there's a great likelihood that our students graduating from a university, they're going to go into this environment. And guess what? There are no silos.
Yeah.
There is no marketing department. You know, you're going to be doing a lot. And to be prepared for that, you know, you've got to be talented in a number of ways. You've got to be really, really flexible. And what I love about the millennial entrepreneurs that I see is they're finding new ways to get the job done. It's so inspiring to me. I just love what I'm seeing out there. And I would like to see more of it. But you can't have an education in these silos anymore. That's just not the way business is being done. And if you look at the way these silos at a lot of large companies, they've got to be breaking down. They're just not adjusting to the new opportunities and the way that business is being done today.
And in thinking of, you know, cross-pollination, more content, you know, the content code in your new book is the latest development in a path that you've been on for really the past couple of years. I mean, I feel like the foundation was in that post that you did on content shock, which I still point to in terms of the future of content. Mm-hmm. So in your eyes, what is the state of content today?
Well, it's funny because a lot of people regarded that blog post I wrote as controversial. And the idea behind it was that we're in this world of overwhelming content density. It's not a novelty anymore. And every number points to this. The world is just being flooded with content. And at the same time, we only have a limited amount of attention span that we can expect from our consumers. So in that environment, naturally, you'd expect it's going to become more and more difficult to stand out over time. I mean, it just makes pretty much common sense to me. And there were more than 800 blog posts written about that blog post. And I could probably count on one hand the number of blog posts that were outright negative about it. Most people, 99% of the people out there say, yep, yeah, I really get it. And what really streamed from that was I became obsessed with what's the answer? And the reason I said that this is kind of a predictable development is if you just look at how the internet has progressed, you know, if you were the first one out there with a website, you'd have an advantage until your competitors caught on. If you were the first one out there with SEO, you had an advantage. Then your competitors caught on, became more difficult, became more expensive. And the same thing now is happening with social media, mobile, and content. It's mature. People have figured it out. It works. And they're flooding into this business, which makes it more difficult for all of us. In fact, I could argue this might be the most difficult time I've ever seen to be in marketing. So I've literally been obsessed with what is the next phase? What do we do next? And that's really the theme behind the book. That's the question that this book answers. And the idea focuses on ignition. All the conversation has been on more content, better content, optimized content, creating content efficiently, building an audience. But the missing link is ignition. The content has no economic value if it doesn't move, if it isn't shared, if people don't connect with it and engage with it. And so, and there's a lot of data behind that, by the way. I mean, I'm kind of hitting the very, very high level. But not only is there a strategic imperative to focus on this, there's an economic imperative to focus on this. So if we now look at content in a different way, the content is not the ultimate goal. It's not the finish line. It's just the starting line. We have to figure out how do we get the content to move. It suggests an entirely new competency. We have to understand, why does content move? Who moves it? Why do they move it? And when you start digging into this, as I do in the book, it is absolutely fascinating. It was mesmerizing to really get into the psychology and the sociology behind this and figure out how can we start applying this for economic benefits for our companies.
Well, you know, I love that central idea too. Like you said, the you know, we kind of focus on all of the kind of the happy kumbaya stuff of how easy and great and wonderful it is to start all of this stuff. But then, you know, we're working hard, cranking out all this work. And in the end, it just seems to many, like you said, that sans ignition, that we're just spinning our wheels. What do you think that so many are missing, are getting wrong?
Well, I think that this idea of ignition is entirely novel. I mean, people just are just not thinking that way. And you know, I'll give you an example. There was an article in Ad Age magazine about 2 weeks ago that was stating there's been this renaissance in investment in SEO, and that almost every major ad agency has doubled their SEO staff in the last 12 months. And the reason, they said, was because all of these brands have bought into the content marketing mantra and are creating record levels of content. They're putting big investments in here, and then they're looking around and nothing's happening. It's not moving. So the ad agency says, well, we can do SEO. We know SEO. And there, I mean, there is some role to SEO, but the difference is that I'm suggesting in the book is that SEO can trick you into discovery. It can trick you into clicking a link, but it can't trick you into sharing. And that is where the value is. It's not on clicking a link. I mean, that's a good first start. But then how do you get into the consumption and the sharing, especially as we get into this phase where the millennials are going to become the major category of consumers by 2020, just 5 years from now. 50% of the consumers are going to be millennials. This is the least trusting generation that the world has ever seen. They do not trust big companies. They do not trust brands and brand messages. But they do trust the messages they share with each other. And even today, studies show that 70% of consumers are influenced by something, a recommendation that they see from someone else. That's why sharing is so important. It's different than a like or a plus one. A like, it just, you just gently bond with something. When you share something, you're raising your hand and saying, this is important. I align with this. This is, you know, I want to share this because this is important to me and it should be important to you.
You know, you talk about millennials, and you know, certainly they, you know, have a high BS meter, so
they do.
You're not gonna pull anything off on them. In the book, you talk about audience development. I mean, what role does that play then in kind of better understanding? I mean, so that we're not, you know, tricking people into, you know, clickbait stuff, but like you said, encouraging that share. How can we better understand who we're talking to and how to move them?
Well, something that's been very rewarding to me is I have an entire chapter devoted to this topic called the alpha audience. And you never know what's going to happen when you publish a book. But I would say that this is the chapter that has excited the most people. This is a chapter that's really creating a lot of buzz. And people are saying, I really hadn't thought about it that way before. And it's exploring this idea of who are these people who are sharing the content. Twitter says that people only retweet one out of every 318 tweets. Facebook reports that one half of 1% of the followers of a brand share their content. This is an elite group of people. Do you really know who they are? Do you know who those people are? Are you embracing them? Are you rewarding them? If this represents 1% of your audience, shouldn't your focus be entirely there and turning that 1% into 2% and 2% into 3%? Because that's creating the economic value. So I'm suggesting in this book that we need to take a more precise and focused look at audience development. Today, all you hear about, all you read about is traffic, driving massive traffic to your blog or driving massive traffic to your site. And that's tourists. They're not staying there. They're not taking any action. And so instead of focusing our resources on traffic, we need to focus our resources on trust, because that builds the emotional connection that leads to engagement And engagement leads to loyalty. And when and loyalty trumps everything. That's your alpha audience. That's what we need to focus on. That's creating the economic value. That's where we need to be spending our time and resources.
You know, it's interesting too, because I think the other side of that, you talk about culturally at organizations, we spend so much time worrying about the bad people. I would say it's probably an even less statistically significant number of those bad people that are going to say and do bad things, but so little time embracing that alpha audience, that little hive that you have that you can cultivate and grow even further.
I love that, Nick. I think that's a really great sentiment. And, you know, I concur that, I mean, I've worked with a lot of different companies, and that's usually one of the first hurdles is, what do we do with the negative stuff? We're afraid of the negative stuff. And when you really do an analysis, they've got nothing to be afraid of. Yeah. I mean, if they've got their ducks in a row and they're running a good ethical company, you know, they're going to be okay. And I mean, it's not to say that you shouldn't be aware of it and you shouldn't be aware of the risk and be ready to deal with it, but it's not something that should keep you from moving forward, because the benefits are overwhelming. And you've got those people out there who love you. I mean, every brand, no matter how non-conversational it might be or how benign it might seem, every company, every brand has fans out there, has conversations going on out there. And you need to be out there. You need to embrace those people, because those are the people who are going to be creating the economic benefits for your company.
So one of the other big ideas in the book is, this being a branding podcast, I obviously gravitated towards this, but talk a little bit about your idea of being a heroic brand.
Well, in this environment where we need to focus on content ignition or content transmission, branding is more important than ever. Sometimes the economic value is not being delivered by the content. It has nothing to do with the content at all, and everything to do with the person, the company, or the brand that's delivering it. I've got examples in my book where people just share content because they believe in something. Everybody has a personal brand, but it takes a certain amount of effort, especially with companies, I think, today, to transcend the content, to transcend SEO, advertising, and promotion, and to get people to share content because you're beloved. Because, you know, they're willing to stand up for you. You've become part of the fabric of their lives. And that's what we've always tried to do with establishing a brand. And it's more important than ever.
So you cite some good examples from personal brands, folks like Gary Vaynerchuk, Jay Baer. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easy, again, with that kind of case study mentality, to think that I'm this type of business, why should I, how can I, how does that translate? I think that that lesson is sometimes lost, but in the end, like you said, we should all aspire to be that I love that you said, because you believe in it, because you're beloved.
Mm-hmm, I think that's, I actually, you know, broach that topic in the book. This word of love, it's not a word that we really talk about in business a lot. But I saw this fellow that there was a picture on the internet of this guy that tattooed a Nike logo on his foot, the swoosh. And I thought, what would make a person do that? Well, actually, my first thought was, man, that must have really hurt. And my second thought was, did this guy just wake up one day and decide, this is the day I'm jogging down to the tattoo parlor. I'm going to emblazon a corporate logo permanently on my body. And of course, it didn't happen that way. It happened because he had a number of provocations with this brand, a number of experiences with this brand over a long period of time that led him to the ultimate marketing success. He loves this company so much, he's going to make it part of his body. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that really an amazing symbol of love? I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, you might put your children in a tattoo, or mom in a tattoo, or someone that you love. And I mean, that's where the conversation needs to go, is how do we really create this love? I mean, it's beyond just awareness. It's almost beyond loyalty. It's how do we get to the next level and create love?
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me that we've almost come kind of full circle, you know, beginning talking about storytelling and love. And I think there's some of these classical, very emotionally driven constructs that can be tricky culturally, as you noted, to broach. You know, what is there anything to creating a culture in which this type of content thrives?
Well, I think it's not as there's something to it. I think it's everything. I mean, I can walk into a company, and generally within the first 30 minutes, I can tell if a social media and content marketing strategy is going to work, just from what you pick up in the way that people talk, in the words that they use. The culture of the company is the number one predictor of success beyond budget or vision or resources. That is what's going to determine whether you're successful. Can you sustain this? I mean, one of the big cultural hurdles is many companies are built on quarterly goals, meeting that quarterly objective. Well, look, to do this right, it's about building relationships. We just talked about building love with an alpha audience. You can't do that in a quarter. And it's hard to measure what the economic benefits are going to be quarter to quarter to quarter. You need to open your eyes and open your mind about how do we measure this in different ways. Maybe it involves more qualitative measures than quantitative measures. Most companies, or many companies, I should say, are not really comfortable with that. They've been built on spreadsheets and it's worked very well for them. But to succeed in this new environment, they need to open their eyes and look at, you know, changes to the culture. So I think it's a huge hurdle, and usually it's the first thing to address. I mean, strategy often doesn't start, you know, with a Facebook page. It starts with the culture.
So is there something in a organization deeply rooted in spreadsheets, is there something that is there some little strategy for starting to approach some things differently to get more qualitative and still kind of meet the current spreadsheet culture, but start to transition things?
Well, you know, the spreadsheet culture has worked really well.
Yeah,
you know, it has. I mean, and so The change has to start with education at the top. There's no such thing as a grassroots cultural change. The people that hold the strategy and hold the budget must understand. That doesn't necessarily mean that they need to blog or they need to tweet, but they need to understand it, and they need to show their support very actively. I just did this case study with Dell, and one of the employees said, "Michael Dell is the most active person we have on our internal social media platform. I think they use Chatter." And he said, he's asking questions all the time about what are we doing? What are we doing with our content? What are we doing with the social media? How can we be doing more? What support do you need from him and others in the organization? That's a culture that's going to move ahead. That's a culture that is primed for success in this environment, because the person at the top gets it. And just like we mentioned Zappos, the person at the top, they set the pace. And so that's where the focus needs to be. That's where the education needs to take place.
if the person at the top doesn't get it, can it be successful?
No, it can't. And I've been, unfortunately, you know, part of situations where I was part of a very, very successful content marketing program. In fact, it was benchmark in every way. They did everything right. And after 2 years, they had 200 volunteers in this company blogging on a regular basis. This is a Fortune 100 company. And the vice president at the top changed. They had an organizational change. And within 30 days, the entire program was dismantled. That's how powerful the culture is. The culture is everything. And it's very, very difficult to change. Changing a culture in a company is no less difficult than walking into France and saying, starting tomorrow, we want you to be more like Russia. No more wine. We want you to drink vodka. No more cheese. We want you to eat caviar. That just ain't going to happen overnight. And there's going to be a lot of resistance. And so it can be that difficult. It really can. And that's why so many big companies are still struggling with these ideas. Because, I mean, this is mature, right? I mean, we've been in the heart of social media and content marketing for 4 or 5 years now, and many are still at 101 because they're not making the cultural changes to sustain it.
I like that, still at 101. Well, your book will help anyone get I love that, the idea of being obsessed with what's next, because the content code will certainly help people get there. As we start to wrap up, what's a brand that's made you smile lately?
There are so many. There are so many. So I'm going to cheat. I'm going to say two real quick.
Go ahead.
One is General Electric. Because they are doing intensely amazing content that is meant to reach out to the bright young people that they want to be hiring for the future, to lead them into the future. I love what they're doing. A second company, really on another end of the spectrum, is Denny's Restaurants. Here's a brand that, you know, you might think of is populated by people in their 60s or 70s having their morning coffee. And they've got a really amazing social media program going on right now to appeal to millennials, and it's working. And it's humorous, it's irreverent, it's lively, and it's certainly making me smile.
That's awesome. Well, I would probably fall into that category that probably thought one way about Denny's, but because of that, I've got to go check that out now.
Mm-hmm.
And where can folks go to learn more about who you are, what you do, and more?
You can find everything about me at businessesgrow.com. Nobody can spell Schaefer, so it had to be something different. And you can find my blog, my books, my podcast, and lots of free resources to help businesses of any size.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in the show notes. Mark, thank you for joining us.
It's been a delight, as always.
And before we go, I want to flip the microphone around to our listeners. Recently, Roberto Cuestas favorited the podcast and gave us a shout on Twitter. Thanks for listening, Roberto. And a reminder, if you heard something that you liked in this episode or another one, give us a holler using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, as I said, I'll link up to everything over at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over to iTunes and click that star button to rate the show. And if you have a few extra seconds, write a couple of sentences and submit a review. Don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital event series. You can learn more about our Digital Strategy Bootcamp and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum featuring Mr. Mark Schaefer and many more right now. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.